Psalm 4. I'll just read the first verse. Answer me when I call, O God, defender of my just cause. You opened up a space for me when I was hemmed in. Be gracious to me and hear my prayer. So it's a cry, as you can tell, from someone who's obviously in a situation where he, she is being unjustly accused. And I think we've all had that. And he's quite confident that God will hear his prayer and come to defend him and answer his plea. One of the points I made last week, and it is worth repeating now, is to realize that the people who wrote the Psalms are necessarily writing out of their own experience. You can't write from anywhere else. And remember, it's all pre-Jesus. So what Jesus revealed of God had not yet been seen. So the author's view of God will be quite limited, quite beautiful, but quite imperfect. And quite, Jesus often said, didn't he, it was said to you of old, but I say to you. So there'll be misunderstandings too in this. There'll be assumptions in it that are actually wrong about God. So if God's going to inspire anyone, he's going to inspire real people with all our limitations of language, history, philosophy, view of the world and everything. Because God doesn't inspire by bypassing the human. He actually inspires the human. And we can all be inspired. We are all inspired. And we can all do beautiful things. And they'll be quite limited, won't they? But in there, there'll be something that's come out of prayer that's quite beautiful. So as we read the Psalms, we don't read them as though all of it is the last word about God, because it clearly isn't. Jesus is the last word about God, and he's far more beautiful than you'll find anything in the Psalms. So you need to, all the time, expect that some of it won't be as right as it could be. For example, in this one, the assumption I talked about last week and do want to say again is that you have to make a choice here. Most people think that God controls the world. Really, underneath it all, that's what people think. And prayer sometimes is wanting God to change the controls or to do something that God wouldn't otherwise do because God is in control. Are you with me? Something of that mentality is there. But I'd only need to ask you to ask yourself a very simple question to see through that. As adults, if someone tries to control your life, do you experience that as love? And I don't think you do. So when we know Jesus showed us a different God, a God who weeps over Jerusalem, he doesn't control it. He says, if only you'd listened. You know, wonderful thing. I would have gathered you together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you wouldn't listen. And so this is going to happen. The temple will be left devoid, you know, all that. Because you didn't listen. Now, if God controls the world, why doesn't he just go in and bomb the lot? Why doesn't he go in and control it? And no, the God that Jesus revealed is love, and actually creates people who can love. That's what human beings are. And God respects the freedom of us, because you can't love without being free. You can't love like a machine. It has to be a free thing, or it's not love. And if you can love, you can hold it back too. This is part of our freedom. Sin is a possibility that we all have. So once I'm sure of this, and I'd like you to think about it, when you're reading any of the Old Testament, but the Psalms included, you have to remember that the authors of these Psalms didn't know Jesus, hadn't seen God weep, hadn't seen God get crucified, you know, hadn't seen God a victim of other people's abuse, hadn't seen that God actually is only love and will never do anything except love. And that has consequences. And it's not because God is limited in God's power, it's because the only power that really exists is love. All the other powers that we see in our world that we call powerful are the abuse of love. They're not powerful. They're actually dreadful because they control. They don't liberate, they don't trust, they don't see the sacred. That's a quick statement and you'd have to qualify it, but I hope you see what I'm trying to get at. So when these authors are asking God to do something, what do we do when we pray? Well, these are all prayers. What do we do? Why do we pray to God if God is not controlling the world? Well, that's a big question. I don't pretend to know the answer, but I've got a bit of an idea about it that you might like to reflect on. God, if God is loving all the time, doesn't need me to pray for God to love you or anybody else or me. God doesn't need us to remind him of our needs or to get him to love, which he wouldn't do if we didn't pray. That makes no sense at all. God is the constant. God is the constant. God's like gravity. It's drawing us all the time. But since God is love, he will not force his way into our life. He won't control. He waits on our yes, like he did for Mary, and she said, "Let it be done unto me." You know, he waits for Jesus, who said, "I always do what I see my Father doing." And that's a free thing that Jesus did. That's the beautiful thing. And it's the same with us. I don't think this is anything strange to you. So when we pray, we're like a flower that opens itself to the sun or the rain. When we pray, we're walking out into the sun that's already there, but we're walking out of the shade. This is a bit of an ugly image, but switching the switch in here doesn't actually do anything to wherever the electricity comes from, but it enables it to come in and turn the lights on. We say yes, and then God's love rushes in, pours in, because we open ourselves to it. Well, this author is opening himself to God's love in prayer, assuming, this is what I suggest you think about, assuming that if he does, God will come in and we'll win the war, the famine will go, you know, my child will live, you got it? Jesus will come down off the cross, everything will be fine, because God will only do what's good. But once you stop thinking like that, you realize that, wait a minute, you could pray all your heart out and still get crucified. God can only do what love does. And maybe other people aren't listening either. God is inspiring Pilate to judge justly, but Pilate isn't listening. So the judgment won't be just, so Jesus will get crucified. That's how it is. The world, if there's any control around, it's the control of people who abuse their freedom. There should be no control. There should be only love, which wants others to be, to grow, that cares for the sacred and all of that. So I think I've said that as clearly as I am able at the moment. Think about it a bit and we can come back to it later. But underneath the Psalms, you won't find what I've said to you. You'll find another assumption. And I wouldn't be able to say what I'm saying to you if there wasn't Jesus. And if we weren't seeing God very differently, and very strangely, really, totally lovingly, and not at all an escape from our need to make decisions that mightn't work because we're not controlling the world. Other people might have more control than us. So with that background, which I hope is okay, come back and read this verse again. Answer me when I call, O God, defender of my just cause. Well, God is the defender of our just cause. God is the one who wants justice. God is the one who's inspiring me to treat you justly and you to treat me justly. God's inspiring everyone in the world to do beautiful, creative, liberating things. That's the whole inspiration. And millions of people are responding, of course, and we're all responding in a bit. But there's this other thing called sin, which is our choice not to respond for whatever reason, fear, etc. And then comes the first of the key symbols of this psalm, which you don't want to miss, and that's why I've translated it so clearly. You've opened up a space for me. when I was hemmed in. And I think we know that feeling. So he's surrounded. There's no way out. Now you can think of that in military terms. He's, you know, surrounded by, or you can think about it in psychological terms. You take it at all. It's a metaphor that covers a lot of things. Being hemmed in by injustice in this case. And God gave him a way out and made space for him. Somehow, how, he doesn't say. So his prayer is then to God, be gracious to me, and I want to spend a few moments on that word now, because it'll come into every psalm pretty well. Be gracious to me and hear my prayer. That word gracious, and we use it in grace, same thing, when applied to God, is so central to the faith of Israel. I will give you this text. You might wish to jot it down. It's Exodus chapter 34, verse 6. And I'll be coming back to that a few times. Because that's really Israel's, the nearest they've got in Israel to a creed. It's the scene where Moses wants to see the face of God. And God says, oh, look, I'm sorry, mate, you can't actually see my face. But I'll tell you what, come up here, and he puts him in the cleft of a rock, and he says, and I'll pass by, but you can't see my face. So God puts his, I don't know how God does all this, but anyway, he covers his eyes in the story. It's quaint, but it's very beautiful. And when he goes by, he takes his hand away, and Moses sees God's back, but not face, you see? In other words, Moses sees not God, but the way to go to be in communion with God. He sees the Torah. That's what it is. It's the way that God's moving. So he knows how to go, how to live, to be in communion with God. But you cannot see the face of God. We can't, and live. So it's in that text. When Yahweh goes by, you have this beautiful text. Yahweh, Yahweh, a God tenderly compassionate and gracious. There's our word. Gracious meaning constantly doing beautiful things for us, constantly favoring us, constantly doing inspiring wonderful things in those around us to love us and etc. Full of grace for us. Slow to anger, abounding in saving kindness and faithfulness. That text, Exodus 34, 6, I haven't got the text here to give you, but that text is, it's the only text like it, is quoted all through the Bible, in the book of Nehemiah, in the book of Jonah, in the Chronicles. It just keeps coming back like a creed. So while in the Old Testament they've got all kinds of confused images of God, which you'd expect, many of them cancel each other out, these are dominant. These are the key, these are the inspired insights. God, I'll read it again, tenderly compassionate, gracious, slow to anger, able to put up with a lot, angry still, we did that last week, I won't do it again now, and abounding in saving kindness and faithfulness. Lovely text, and as I said, often repeated. So it's picked up as their central view. On that idea of being hemmed in and finding space, I thought I might read for you from the New Testament. This is Ephesians chapter 3, verse 18 and 19. And you'll be familiar with this text, but I'll just read it to you. I pray, says Paul to his community, that you may have the power to comprehend with all the saints, meaning all the holy, all the community, the Christian community, to comprehend what is the breadth and length and height and depth. And what does that mean? Well, obviously, you've got all of it, the whole comprehensive cosmic space of it. And what he's talking about is the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge. The love of Christ, which is the breadth and length and height and depth of everything, so that you may be filled with the fullness of God. It's a beautiful prayer, isn't it? That you'll be so open to the mystery, there'll be no limits to where that you'll be able to receive God's grace from the whole 360 degrees of life and be in communion with Christ's love, which is actually beyond your comprehension, but open to it all.